This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, you're listening to Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. Unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, aren't just taking over airspace in this country, they're also taking over pilot positions, particularly in the military, and to some extent in the agricultural industry. And it's a trend that will likely only continue to grow and expand into other segments. Today, we're speaking with Jeff Kappenman. Jeff's director of the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Center for Research, Education, and Training at the University of North Dakota. The university has long offered extensive pilot training programs, but recently rolled out a first-in-the-nation, and maybe first-in-the-world, degree in unmanned aircraft operations. We're speaking with Jeff to get his thoughts on how the integration of unmanned vehicles may progress and how it may affect the roles of future pilots. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Glenn.
Now, we wrote a news item back in January covering the UAV program's rollout at UND, and one particular quote from that item caught my eye. I know it caught a lot of other eyes, too. That was a quote from a former fighter pilot and current instructor, Mike Nelson, who said, "The last fighter pilot's already been born." Is that where we are? Expand on that, if you would. Where is the technology now, and where are we going?
To be fair to Mike, yeah, I don't think he's the first person that has said that quote. I think he's actually borrowed it from some others, but it's something that's commonly spoken about, you know, in the UAS community. But it's a burgeoning market. We see it here as aviation's next evolution. I mean, these are aviation-based platforms. It's important to note, though, it's more than just the air vehicle itself. I mean, we tend to focus on that because that's what we know and we're comfortable with because of our previous 80-some years of manned aviation flying. But I wanted to make the point, it is a system, so it is more complex in a sense than a manned platform. We look at it as there's four primary components: the air vehicle, the ground control station, where today's pilots or operators, whatever you want to call them, actually sit and operate the air vehicle, fly the air vehicle. Then you have the data links portion, which is obviously those spectrum bandwidth radio frequency pieces that allow the pilots inside the GCS to command and control the air vehicle. And then you have the payloads themselves. And that's really why UAVs are so popular, is because of what you can put on board. In a sense, the platform really is just a truck, and put the platforms you want to on the truck to either see things or hear things or do things. And then, of course, you've got the human involved. And today, there are humans that are in the loop, and I think there are people that want to take the technology to where the human is kind of on the loop, not necessarily directly involved in some of those activities I just talked about, but maybe more in kind of a monitoring mode. And as technology continues to miniaturize all the capabilities that we can put in the GCS or on the platform, you can continually pull the human further out of the loop.
And along those lines, are we really there in 20 years? Is it going to be the case that we're going to be looking more and more at unmanned vehicles and less at manned aircraft? What do you think?
20 years from now, what we will probably see is it would be likely that the large kind of carriers that carry the mail, and I'm not speaking for them, I mean kind of the FedEx, UPS type organizations, certainly maybe their overwater routes, long distance, overnight sort of routes, would fly those completely unmanned.
So do you think the introduction of a UAV program at UND indicates the beginning of this shift? Do you think that over time the course offerings at UND will transform from actual flight programs to unmanned flight training?
Almost certainly. We definitely see that. We had our first course this past fall, and from the fall to this spring semester, our enrollment tripled. And we get calls, emails all the time from kids that are interested in the program. Either they're already in college somewhere, or they're a junior or senior in high school, and they see something about our program online, and they get very interested. In fact, right before you called, I was talking to a mother and her son about what were the requirements today to become a UAS pilot. I mean, we do that all the time here, and we see a tremendous growth here at the University of North Dakota with UAS. We focus in three areas, and you mentioned them, you know, research, which there's a lot of that to do, education, which we're talking about now, and then the training portion of it. And we don't separate training from education in the sense of Our MAN program's been here for 42 years, and it's a liberal arts degree. And we've been creating the college-educated pilot with a liberal arts degree background that has gone to work for the major airlines over the years, or gone into the military. And we see the same thing happening here, the same kind of expansion going on. I mean, if you think back, there were days where, you know, you didn't get on an elevator unless the elevator operator was on there with you, because it was just too complex piece of equipment for the standard person to get on without someone trained to be on there. And you can say the same thing of trains that are now metros that you get on that are automatically run. There might be a day before you and I pass that, frankly, manned aviation is kind of like the collection car industry today, where a 64 Mustang really cannot compete with anything that's current technology on the road, but you just want to have one because you want to have one, and you find some pleasure in operating it and driving it and owning it. Same thing with manned aviation. You might be able to get on a plane and fly somewhere, and there might not be anybody up front flying it, but you might own your own airplane because you find it, you know, pleasurable to have one, and you enjoy the experience of flying it. I think that'll always be there. Flying has always been one of those kind of ultimate goals of mankind over all the years, to be able to get in something and soar out on the wind. And I know I feel that way. Having UAS in the industry won't change much of that.
Well, what are the real benefits of unmanned versus manned vehicles? Where do they really shine?
Where the unmanned capability shines is, and this is a little bit of a cliche already today, is in those dull, dirty, kind of dangerous mission areas, we'll call them, where maybe we don't want to expose our people to, you know, a certain amount of danger, or the mission is so dull, like flying, say, telephone lines or pipelines, that we just don't want to involve a person to do that, where we can do it unmanned. And when we say dirty, we really, you know, that's kind of from a military aspect, where we're talking about like a nuclear, biological, chemical kind of a profile, where we certainly wouldn't want to expose our people to flying in that kind of environment. So an unmanned solution is perfect. But beyond that, obviously, is just there's such a long dwell capability. You just don't have the human in the cockpit, and you're not restricted to those physiological needs, basically. You can get up and get out of the GCS and eat or do whatever it is you need to do. We can just change out the people on the ground. But the platform is capable of being up there for more than 24 hours. And we have several examples of platforms today that fly for more than 24 hours. So that you have this long dwell capability as well.
Well, so what about commercial and general aviation? You touched on it a little bit there, but how do you think automation and unmanned cockpits will translate across those lines? And do you think that change would come quickly, slowly, or maybe not at all?
Well, I guess what I'd say there, Glenn, is so much motion on the or movement, if you will, on the unmanned front is because of America's involvement in the global war on terrorism, if you will. And so I believe that over the last, say, 5 years, we've moved the technology 20 years because of the battlefield needs. Without that need and the involvement of the dollars and the research and additional resources, we still would probably just be tinkering around with it. But because of its success on the modern day battlefield, if you will, there's a lot of push to bring that technology into the civilian side. And there's so many places it can be used. You know, Fish and Wildlife, or the Weather Service, Department of Energy, you know, land management, and agriculture, NASA's looking at them, on and on and on. Obviously, the Customs and Border Protection Agency folks are using them. But the number one challenge of that is, of course, the integration of these platforms into the national airspace, which is something, obviously, we don't have to face in our overseas efforts in the Iraq or Afghanistan theater. They still have to do airspace management. We just don't have a very mature and very busy American-type national airspace that we operate in. But if you would go to, say, Balad in Iraq there, you would see manned and unmanned platforms taking off and landing and taxiing next to one another all day and all night.
Well, now, what are your thoughts on how we'll be integrating pilots into what seems to be progressively more automated equation? What will the role be, and how will training be different for those pilots, be it of manned or unmanned vehicles? What challenges will the pilots' instructors need to overcome?
Well, you're still going to have the same basic training. And so I guess what I would say, like I said, it's an aviation-based platform. So the let's just say for the sake of this argument, we're going to say the person's not a pilot but an operator, which is an Army term if today, if you will, in today's service vernacular. The Air Force uses trained pilots, and the Army uses trained enlisted operators. And so if we're talking about an operator, that operator is still going to have all the appropriate ground school necessary to fly the air vehicle in the airspace, and all the FAA-type training that you would need to have to fly in today's airspace. You're going to have to know how to do weight and balance. You're going to have to know how to read the weather. You're going to have to know what VFR flight routes are. You're going to have to know how to interact and communicate with ATC. You're going to have to know how to react to emergency procedures, on and on and on. All that training is still going to have to be there.
Well, now, what are the specific goals of the program at UND as it sits right now?
You know, it depends on kind of what pillar we're talking about. Since we're kind of on the training topic, what we're looking to do from a UND perspective is we already have a couple individuals who are former Air Force pilots that are MQ-1, MQ-9 rated that are subcontracted to General Atomics at the nearby Grand Forks Air Force Base, and they help the Customs and Border Protection folks learn how to fly the MQ-9 Reaper.
MQ-1 and MQ-9 being unmanned aerial vehicles, correct?
Yes, those are fairly large platforms with 20 plus hours of endurance that are employed both by the American military and are also employed by the Customs and Border Protection folks.
It's fascinating stuff, Jeff. We thank you for taking the time. This has been Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. We've been speaking with Jeff Kappenman, director of the Unmanned Aircraft System Center for Research, Education, and Training at the University of North Dakota. You can find the university online at und.edu. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. For more on aviation safety, log on to www.aviationsafetymagazine.com.